send it out. Oh, Lordy, dear.
With None of Us Are Free. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, May the 27th, Memorial Day, and I hope you're doing fine. And we are about to pick up on the second half of a lecture by Dr. Gerald Horn. You will remember that he was with us talking about African Americans and the world, and today more on the synergy in struggle. Dr. Horn is a noted historian, political scientist, social critic, and author, and he has been a prolific, I mean, just, I don't know how he still manages to be cogent. He writes incessantly. He has produced more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. He is the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. At the undergraduate level, he teaches courses in the civil rights movement and the U.S. history through film. At the graduate level, he teaches diplomatic history, labor history, and 20th century African-American history. Gerald Horn, thank you for being with us again today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and how does my voice sound?
You sound great. You sound fantastic. Well, this is how we're going to do it, as we did before. Dr. Horn will be speaking. He will give his presentation uninterrupted, and then we ask questions after about 30 minutes or so.
Oh.
would that work, or do you want to do something different?
Well, you know, since I did that last time, and I think probably strained the patience of the audience with my talking, it would probably be preferable this time if you would just ask me some questions following up on my last lecture, or perhaps the audience could ask me some questions following up on my last appearance on this program.
All right. Well, that is fine. We can, you know, the idea is, first I should let you know, your lecture was so well received, got so many emails and comments about what a fantastic experience it was listening and also learning so much about the way you put it. You put the domestic struggle of African Americans in an international, gave it an international point of reference. And it was all the more meaningful because you presented it that way. All right, well, we'll go this way. People will have a chance to ask you questions. 888-874-4888 if you'd like to ask Dr. Gerald Horn a question based on his previous lecture or any question at all. And
I can start off, though.
Okay, good. Go right ahead, please.
Well, you know, for the last week or so, I was in Paris. I'm working on a book on the Haitian Revolution. And one of the many points that I'm considering in this project is the origins of the Dominican Republic. As you know, Haiti and the Dominican Republic share the island of Hispaniola. During the Haitian Revolution, of course, the victorious Haitians on the western side of the island basically controlled the entire island. At least by 1822, they had controlled the entire island. But in the 1840s, a revolt against Haitian rule was engineered, not least a revolt by remaining Spanish settlers on the island, assisted by Madrid, and also assisted by the United States, which had a bone to pick with Haiti, since Haiti immediately abolished slavery upon triumphing in this revolution. And as you know, the United States had to fight a bloody civil war in order to abolish slavery in 1865. And it's very curious that the Dominican Republic basically won independence in a revolt against an abolitionist Haiti, a revolt against a black government. And this may shed light, to fast forward, on a very interesting picture that you may recall that appeared a few months ago of the former Chicago Cubs slugger, Sammy Sosa, whose roots are in the Dominican Republic. And if you accept what you saw in this picture, he had basically sought to lighten his skin and to remove the melanin content from his skin. And in a situation like this, it's important not to just see that as something personal on the part of Sammy Sosa, but to see that as part of a larger historical process whereby you were born and emerged from a country, the Dominican Republic, that was born in a revolt against an abolitionist black nation, that is to say Haiti, or for that matter, even if you don't accept what is said about Sammy Sosa, recall that the Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo, at a time in the 1930s that most nations, including the United States and a number of European nations, were rejecting Jewish people fleeing fascism, Rafael Trujillo opened his doors wide to these refugees, basically because they were melanin deficient. And of course, there's still a substantial Jewish population in the Dominican to this very day. But one of the things I was investigating also was the fact that in the 1870s, the United States was trying to annex the entire island of Hispaniola. And it was going to deport many of the population we would now call African American to Hispaniola. Of course, nothing new. During the Lincoln administration, there was much discussion of deporting the newly freed African population of the South to many countries. There were discussions with Brazil. There were discussions with Ecuador. There were discussions with many countries, but for better or for worse, these countries said, thank you very much, but we think we have enough Africans. So you still have this African-American population in the United States. What's interesting is that this attempt to annex Hispaniola failed. But you have to consider that if it had succeeded, Hispaniola, including Haiti and the Dominican Republic, would be a state of the United States of America, which is something to consider. Now, I'll take a break and move on to another point if you'd like, or stand for questions and interrogation.
No, go right ahead.
Another point is of more contemporary relevance. You recall that during my last appearance on your show, I talked about China, and there was a call with regard to China, and I hope that caller calls again. But one of the major points of focus and emphasis of the Obama administration is the so-called reset with Moscow and the pivot towards China, that is to say, to focus more on China. And you might recall that during the 2012 presidential race, Mitt Romney, the GOP presidential nominee, basically called Russia the main geopolitical antagonist of the United States of America. And there's a real split in elite circles in the United States as to whether to focus on Moscow or whether to focus on Beijing, which is very curious, I must say. But what's happening is that, of course, the Obama administration holds power, so they're going full speed ahead with the pivot towards Asia. And part of this involves a new role for Japan. And just as after Nixon's trip to China some four decades ago, the United States began to build up China to confront Moscow. Now the United States is acquiescing to a kind of Japanese nationalism in order to confront Beijing, in order to confront China. And this is included acquiescing to the weakening of the Japanese currency, the yen, which, of course, is boosting Japanese exports, including in the auto sector, which should always be of relevance to the people in Detroit, since if you look at the future of the auto market, you see General Motors, which is oftentimes called Government Motors because of its assistance from the U.S. Treasury, is busily expanding in China as it's retrenching in Michigan. Likewise, with Toyota surging with the weakening of the yen, that also is going to be a moment and of relevance to Michigan because, of course, Toyota was already a major competitor to Detroit, and not to mention Honda and Nissan. And with the new role for Japan in terms of confronting China, it's clear that Washington is going to be favoring Japan to a degree, and that's going to have repercussions in Michigan. That's going to have repercussions in the streets of Detroit. So I'll stop for a second and see if there are any comments or questions.
Well, I'd like to ask the first one. Just this past week, a group of black rights associations in France actually sued or gave notice that they will be suing over compensation payments that the bank collected for slave owners in Haiti. And, of course, they want the compensation back. This was going back to the old colonial days when, in fact, the freedom of Haiti came with a price tag. And the slaves literally had to buy their freedom, pay the oppressor to cease and desist. And have you followed that at all?
Oh, yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, approximately a week ago, I was in Paris examining petitions from former colonists, particularly from Bordeaux, a major wine-producing region of France, but who had been expelled from Hispaniola because of the success of the Haitian Revolution. And as you know, in the mid-1820s, Haiti and France negotiated that accord that you just made reference to, by basically Haiti was reparations to France and to the former slave owners of France. But what happened was that by the 1830s, the Haitians had begun to slow down in terms of their repayments. And so I was looking at these petitions from these former slave owners in Bordeaux, I've been living in Bordeaux in the 1830s, who were petitioning the French government, trying to put pressure on the French government so the French government would in turn put pressure on. Likewise, just a few days ago after returning from France, I was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Actually, I'm speaking to you right now from Chapel Hill. And I was looking at letters from a former colonist in Hispaniola who had been expelled because of the Haitian Revolution. Then he wound up in Tennessee. And he was petitioning the U.S. government to put pressure on Haiti because of his supposed loss after slavery was abolished. In fact, one of the bones of contention between a beleaguered Haiti and the slave-owning powers, the United States in the first place, was this whole idea of compensating the slave owners, some of whom had moved, as you know, not only back to Bordeaux, but to New Orleans, which, as you know, had been a French colony for decades before joining the United States of America as part of Louisiana in 1803. And, of course, many of these slave owners who had been expelled from Hispaniola, they wound up settling in Baltimore and Norfolk and New York, in addition to New Orleans. And they were all, of course, pressuring the U.S. government to pressure the nation. And one of the sad and tragic aspects of Haitian history is that this small island had to arm itself in order to prevent military incursion by these former slave-owning powers. And as a result of devoting so much of its treasury to the military, obviously any dollar that went to the military couldn't go to education, couldn't go to health care. And in terms of the present state of affairs in Haiti, one can say that it's directly connected to the pressure that the slave-owning nations, including the United States, put on Haiti shortly after the triumph of the revolution in 1804.
Right. They were required to pay at that time 150 million francs as compensation to the former slave owners. And although it was reduced, it took Haiti up until 1947 to repay that debt. And in today's money, that is comparable, the estimation goes, to about $21 billion. So all of this money is being asked for. And is there, you think, a solid case for this?
A solid case for Haiti demanding its money back?
Yes.
Oh, sure. But, you know, it's just like reparations in the United States. You know, as you know, there is this movement amongst the descendants of enslaved Africans in North America to demand reparations. But as I've said on many occasions and written more than once, that the strength of a reparations case basically turns on the influence and power you can generate in the international community to put pressure on those from whom you're demanding reparations. In other words, it's just not enough to say, I have a very good case, I have a sound case, these principles make sense. I mean, that's a good start, I must say. But ultimately, and I say this particularly to reparations activists in Port-au-Prince and also in New York and elsewhere, is that you got to lobby Beijing, you got to lobby Moscow, you know, you got to lobby Havana. I mean, you have to generate some influence and clout in the international community. I mean, to think that all you have to do is, I'm not sure what the strategy is, but you got to go beyond towards the United States if you want reparations in the United States. That's my simple point. And I think the Haitians realize that. As a matter of fact, the Caribbean nations in general have been pressing a case for reparations, but I guess, to be fair, you know, they have an advantage because these Caribbean islands have sovereignty. And because they have sovereignty, that means they have a vote in the United Nations, they have a vote in the Organization of American States, that means they have diplomats posted all over the globe, whereas for various reasons, the African Americans, of course, don't have sovereignty and do not tend to think globally, interestingly enough, even though they are well connected compared to other Africans on the internet and theoretically should be more in tune with what's going on in the world. But what I've found is that they're less in tune than, say, their counterparts in Jamaica or Haiti or Cape Town and elsewhere.
We're talking with Dr. Gerald Horn, and we're looking at the African-American struggle in the context of the global perspective. We have a call, Johnson from Staten Island. Your call at 888-874-4888. Johnson from Staten Island, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice, and good afternoon to the professor. Excellent program a few days ago and today. One of my questions to the professor, first I would like to say rest in peace to Jetu Wiyusi, a great educator like the professor. You know, he passed away.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask him, because last time in this conversation, he spoke about Haiti, and I'm glad he opened up with that today, because what he is postulating about the African diaspora in Haiti.
Oh, you're speaking directly with him, by the way, so you can ask him directly.
Okay, Professor, my question to you, the Haitian liberation of New Orleans here in America, when the Haitian army and the troops fought to liberate New Orleans in direct relationship to the defeat of Napoleon when they fought their revolution in Haiti, the black field marshal, Toussaint Louverture, was he one of the reasons why that the heroic Haitian people are suffering to this day is because there was the first republic that defeated a white army?
Gerald?
Yes. Well, this is what I would say in response to that question. As many listeners may know, Toussaint Louverture was the great hero of the Haitian Revolution, but also, as listeners may know, in a treacherous manner, he was detained and captured by French forces and bundled away from Hispaniola, where he died, in Europe. Now, with regard to Louisiana, the original plan of the French colonialists was to have the territory that they purportedly controlled surrounding New Orleans serve as sort of a bread basket to feed Hispaniola, Hispaniola being one of the most profitable sites on planet Earth because of sugar production. Sugar at that time was not only used to sweeten coffee, but it was also used as a medicinal. It was seen as sort of a wonder drug. And so sugar was quite profitable, and Haiti was the most profitable of the sugar colonies. However, with the triumph of the Haitian Revolution by 1804, and it was apparent that even before 1804 that the Africans and their allies would prevail, Paris decided that the territory surrounding New Orleans was not as relevant, and that in any case, they would have to contend for control of that area with the United States. And this is at a time when the French Empire is overstretched. Recall that it was in the late 1790s that the French forces had invaded Egypt, that around 1812, you might recall, Tchaikovsky's, the Russian composer's 1812 Overture, which was basically written at a time when Napoleon and his forces had invaded Russia and then were routed. So France was overstretched. So it decided to basically liquidate its holdings surrounding New Orleans, which led to that entire territory, not only Louisiana, but stretching northward through Missouri up to what is now the Canadian border. Now, keep in mind that this is very curious because in many ways you had France selling territory to the United States that basically was Native American territory. I mean, really. But as you know, and as I was trying to impress upon the audience a few moments ago, in the international community in general, both domestic and global, what matters is power, much more say than having a good argument, although having a good argument can be useful. And so it was through such means that the United States gained all this territory in a virtual fire sale from Napoleon, which was basically engineered as a result of African.
Thank you, Professor.
Thanks a lot. We have Orville from New York. You're on the air with Professor Gerald Horn.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Professor Horn, it's a pleasure to speak with you. It's amazing to be able to do so. Thank you. I wanted to ask, you mentioned reparations and Haitian reparations and also enslaved blacks throughout the diaspora, but the USA. And it seems that in order to get it on the world stage and have a push and an agreement, that first you would have to do it with those who experienced it and are coming out of it. And I don't believe that the reparation movements have actually done so in terms of educating that population and also showing a network and a vision of what that, you know, what would come from it. So I think even, I think reparations is interesting. I do believe in it, but it hasn't even been brought home. So that's one thing. And also, I'm curious about your overall view of Zimbabwe and how it's viewed on the world stage, including here amongst former enslaved peoples throughout the diaspora. Because, again, here you have something that I think that is linked somehow to reparations when we look at what's happening in Zimbabwe and what they're experiencing. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm just amazed. And thank you, Utrecht.
Thanks a lot.
What was that second point, my overall view of what?
Zimbabwe.
My overall view of Zimbabwe. Well.
Yes.
The caller happened to ask me a question that I'm quite familiar with. First of all, I would be remiss if I did not mention my book on Zimbabwe, From the Barrel of a Gun, which basically details the role of the United States in trying to foil the War of Liberation that led to the creation of Zimbabwe in the spring of 1980. You may recall that it was in November 1965 that the European minority in what was then Rhodesia, under the leadership of Ian Smith, made a unilateral declaration of independence. Basically, the Europeans in what we now call Zimbabwe were trying to escape the logic of decolonization. You know that this weekend in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the African Union, formerly the Organization of African Unity, is marking its 50th anniversary, coming together in May 1963. And the winds of change, as former British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan put it, were coursing through Rhodesia in 1965, which led to this unilateral declaration of independence and an attempt to set up a twin to apartheid South Africa. And that effort failed, not least because the Africans were able to organize and were able to arm themselves because of assistance from the Cuban, the then Soviet Union, some Scandinavian countries, and friendly forces throughout the world, including the United States, and were able to defeat Ian Smith and his comrades. Now, in the book on 1776, which will be out in a few months, I draw a parallel between the unilateral Declaration of Independence in November 1965 of Ian Smith and the unilateral Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776, which likewise was designed to escape the winds of change, in this case, the logic of abolition of slavery. You know that in June 1772, London was already moving towards abolition. I think I mentioned that the last time I was on this program. And one of the things that's in this book that I still find astonishing is that in 1772, the colonizing power, London, was making proposals with regard to rights for Africans that did not come to the African population in the United States until the 1960s. Almost 200 years later. I mean, I still find that mind-boggling. In any case, to fast forward, of course, the Africans in Zimbabwe were able to win their independence. They just marked their 33rd year of independence just this past month. Elections will be held in Zimbabwe within the next month or two or three or four. Actually, that was just solidified.
You're kind of breaking up a little bit, Gerald.
Okay, you can take a break and come online if you want.
All right, I will. We'll do that. We'll take a break and we'll get a landline and we'll be right back right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Our guest is the esteemed Professor Gerald Horn, who, among other things, I mean, all of the other things that he does, among all of those things, I'm going to ask you a question because you are a lawyer as well. And it's in that capacity, Gerald, I wanted to ask you, going back to the question of Haiti making this claim against the banks that basically benefited from this massive payment that it managed through great sacrifice to pay off in 1947, which is estimated today as at about $21 billion. How would you position the legal argument here by Haiti to be reimbursed and to be compensated?
Well, to reiterate, I mean, I think the legal argument is important, but if I were involved in that case, one of the first things I would do would be an assessment of the global correlation of forces. I'd recognize that there's a European debt crisis that's afflicting Paris tremendously, that as a result, President Hollande was in Beijing with his begging bowl just a week or so ago. And if I were part of the Haitian leadership, one of the first things I would try to do is have urgent consultations with the Chinese friends. Now, my understanding is that Haiti does not recognize the Beijing government as the lawful government of China. I think they still recognize Taiwan, if I'm not mistaken. But in any case, if that is the case, I would certainly switch allegiances sooner rather than later. I would also be sending emissaries to Brazil and Russia. In other words, I'd have a political campaign. And then secondly, I turn to the legal arguments. That is to say, the fact that I would say under any iteration of law that the idea that slaves should be compensating their slave masters should be seen as abhorrent, and that for such a violation of law, there should be no statute of limitations. That is to say, there should be no sort of idea that if you didn't file this claim in 1947 or 1826, it's basically become stale. I would say that, like in certain jurisdictions, there's no statute of limitations with regard to murder. You can always be prosecuted for that, even 60 years later. I mean, look at what's happening with these prison guards and concentration camps in Europe who are still being chased down 70 years later. Well, I would say that likewise, the same holds true with regard to these slave owners and their descendants, and the descendants in the first place being the government in Paris. So that would be my two-pronged approach. First of all, a political approach, and second of all, a legal approach.
The other question, and it was germane to something I was going to ask you about the celebration or the recognition of the African Union, formerly the Organization of African States. The question about neo-colonialism, yes, colonialism in its strictest sense is no more, but of course we have neo-colonial arrangements that make it pretty much the same in terms of the wealth of the country, not owned by the country, and in some cases not managed by the country, but still under the control of foreign forces. Now, how does that play into this notion of sovereignty? I mean, I raised a question about the Caribbean, where, of course, most of it British, but the Queen still is on currency throughout the Caribbean. They still have the phenomenon of crown lands. That's Britain owning lots of acreage in all of these countries, and you still have the issue of major cases, especially cases on appeal, being taken up in London because they just have not formed in 50 years. The Caribbean does not have an appellate division, a kind of a Supreme Court. How do you raise this question about complete severance? Is it impossible, or is it that one of the conditions in a way is to tolerate a just an easing of the political arrangements. Call it independence or call it sovereignty, but really the structural foundations are still very much the same as in colonial times.
Well, you raise a very complicated question. I mean, particularly with regard to small Caribbean islands, Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, a part of the problem is that they have tried, as you know, to come together in a federation and in a union, not unlike the European Union. I'm speaking of CARICOM, the Community of Caribbean States. But as you know, part of the problem there is that many of these islands are reluctant to cede sovereignty to a federal union, so to speak, mentioning, that is to say, speaking of CARICOM, and that has been a stumbling block into a deeper integration of these small Caribbean islands. And as a result of their difficulty in integrating their economies and society, that makes them more susceptible to being dominated, if you like, from London. The second point that I would mention is that part of the reason why historically it seems to me many of these Caribbean states have acceded to a certain kind of influence from London is because historically they were, I would say particularly in the late 19th century, when they were not independent. As you know, Jamaica doesn't come to independence until 1962 and most of the Caribbean islands around that time. But historically, there had been a fear of being dominated by the United States, which is totally understandable. In fact, as you know, I did a book a few years ago called The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War. And I won't go into the substance of that book because I think I did that the last time. But what's relevant here is that I went out to Fiji in the South Sea, where the people are melanin rich and have hair like mine and other people of African descent. As a matter of fact, this is a sort of sarcastic joke. When I was out there, I was thinking, well, you know, the Johnson Haircare products, if they could come out here, they'd find a whole new market. For getting these sisters to straighten their hair, and the brothers too, for that matter. But in any case, one of the things I found is that in some ways what happened in the 1870s was that Fiji basically acceded to becoming part of the British Empire because they were so fearful of the United States moving in. That is to say, they didn't feel that they could stand up to the United States. They felt they needed to be part of a wider and larger entity. And so they acceded to the United States. They acceded to the British Empire, I should say. And so I think that this question of neocolonialism is a bit complicated, although I would say that today there is a possibility of neocolonialism being eroded, a greater possibility than there has been for some time, because as we know, the world is changing. I mean, the leading countries going forward in this century will be China and Brazil and Russia, India. And these countries have not historically been the colonizing powers in either the Caribbean or Africa. And so this opens up the opportunity for the African nations and the Caribbean nations to sort of play off of or to work the contradictions between the former colonizing powers and these rising powers to the benefit of Africa and the Caribbean.
888-874-4888 to talk with Dr. Gerald Horn. Of course, you know that Vice President Biden is making a swing through South America and the Caribbean. And in Trinidad, where he's expected to go, Prime Minister of Trinidad has invited all the heads of state of the Caribbean to meet with him. This comes after, well, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she did comment that there was great concern about the aggressive investment China is making throughout the Caribbean. But in other words, you know, China is gobbling up, really. China is gobbling up a lot of resources in Africa and the Caribbean, and it's very aggressive. And it's also doing certain things. For example, in Jamaica, as you know, Jamaica produces sugar and is not allowed. It's actually prohibited from selling even an ounce of sugar on the international market. That is controlled strictly by London, and London calls the shots on any sugar produced in Jamaica. The Chinese have begun to buy up the sugar estates in Jamaica and presumably will be selling and trading sugar, not Britain. So we expect to get some resistance there. Do you think that this polarity between China and the United States, this is where we see the power play is between China and the United States now, and the United States recognizes that it needs to have greater hemispheric control?
Well, first of all, it's quite striking that President Xi Jinping of China is coming to California by June 6th or 7th, and before he lands in California, he will also be going through Trinidad and Tobago, Port of Spain. And I would assume, or I would imagine, that the leadership in Port of Spain might be inviting the Caribbean leadership to meet with the Chinese president, just as they're inviting the leadership to meet with the U.S. vice president. The second point that I would like to make, and this is something that people really need to ponder and understand, is that you cannot begin to understand China's rise unless you begin to understand how, after Nixon's trip to Beijing some four decades ago, U.S. foreign direct investment began to pour into China, building up that economy because of fear and fright of the Soviet Union. Just as I was saying at the top of the program, now there's fear and fright of China, and so they're now trying to resuscitate the Japanese economy. And so I think it's one thing for people on the back end to begin to grumble and mumble about the new role of China and what it's doing in Africa and what it's doing in the Caribbean. Fair enough. But you may need to grumble and mumble at the front end as these things are unfolding. I mean, it's almost like, you know, don't wait until the deal is done before you begin to pay attention. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my lesson. I mean, it seems obvious, but apparently that needs to be said. Now, with regard to China's new role, I think it's fair to say that developing nations, African and Caribbean nations, benefit more when there are big powers competing for their attention and affections, as opposed to the situation, say, between 1991 and, say, 2010, when there was the so-called unipolar world where the United States was bestriding the planet like a colossus, and you either had to bend to the will of Uncle Sam or suffer. But now, of course, there are alternatives and choices. Now, this does not mean we've reached Shangri-La. That does not mean we've reached paradise. It just means that the situation now is measurably better than it was a few years ago. And certainly there are going to be strains in terms of working out this new relationship with China. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But at the same time, I would caution our friends in the Caribbean and Africa not to join in this China bashing. In fact, I don't think I have to caution them, because most of the China bashing, all the hysteria about China's new role, at least in Africa, it's not necessarily coming from Africans, it's coming from North Americans, interestingly enough. And I mean North Americans. I don't mean just white Americans. I mean also black Americans. It's not necessarily coming from Africa. Even if you look at Zambia, Michael Sata, the president who was elected some months ago, after expressing some apprehension about Chinese interest in the copper mines, which is Zambia's major resource, well, since he's taken power, he's changed his tune, which is understandable. Because if he didn't change his tune, he would have been sort of an odd man out in terms of his neighbors, particularly in Zimbabwe, where China is now a major force, but also South Africa, where China is united with South Africa in the BRICS alliance. So I would suggest that before there's some sort of knee-jerk reaction, some sort of untutored reaction to this new correlation of forces, that people begin to try to acquaint themselves with the history, first of all, and then try to acquaint themselves with the opinions and attitudes that are emerging from Africa itself.
Finally, I want to ask this. I mean, it may ruffle some feathers out there, but I think many African Americans have an emotional attachment, and in some cases, a symbolic attachment to Africa rather than a real attachment to Africa. As a whole, is that because there is no real collectivity in terms of leadership, what accounts for this fractured relationship between African Americans and Africa?
Well, in the first place, I think it stems from how Black Americans were able to erode Jim Crow, and that involved not only militant struggle, but it involved a deal whereby the centrist leadership and the NAACP in particular basically threw overboard the left-wing leadership that had global connections, Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, etc. And the payoff was Brown versus Board of Education, was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965, the latter two, of course. Well, I should say that the latter, Voting Rights Act of 1965, on the verge of being gutted by the Supreme Court within days. And once that deal was cut, and people like Du Bois and Robeson, who were, of course, our leading specialists on Africa, were basically tossed overboard, tossed into purgatory, well, of course, there would be sort of this attenuated relationship to the African continent. I mean, I know that there's all this celebration of Nelson Mandela, understandably and justifiably, but, Eutrice, I lived in New York in the 1970s and 1980s, and I was heavily involved in the anti-apartheid movement, as you know. And these gray hairs I have on my head came honestly. And, I remember when a lot of Black Americans stood down from Nelson Mandela when he was in jail because they accepted Dick Cheney's opinion that he was a dupe of the Communist Party of South Africa. And they were afraid to cross that opinion of Dick Cheney and those who backed them. And so there's always been this sort of strange attitude, it seems to me, of Black Americans to Africa. I think it's an attenuated attitude. That is to say that they know it's important, all they have to do is look in the mirror. But at the same time, they're leery of crossing the U.S. ruling elite, which, of course, has this hysteria even to this day about communism, and they don't want to get in hot water by seeming to be on the side of communism, for example. Now, to China's new role, the U.S. ruling elite, at least a wing of it, is concerned about China and Africa, so that they have to be in accord with that. And so it's difficult to serve two masters, I guess is what I'm saying, particularly when one of the masters, speaking of the U.S. ruling elite, is so right-wing, and whose very essence is basically constructed historically upon a denigration of people of African descent. So obviously that's going to make for a very difficult, if not strange, position that African Americans are forced to take with regard to Africa.
Wow. So give us a summary, Gerald, of what we should be thinking from these two lectures that you gave us today.
Well, I think what we should be thinking is that there are a number of turning points that take place in world history. Of course, one is 1492, which helps to explain why people like yourself and myself are now in this hemisphere. Another 1776, the revolt against British rule. I mean, I could go on. But I think we're at another turning point right now with the rise of China, the resurgence of Japan, the new role for Brazil and Russia, and South Africa and India, and that when the earth beneath our feet begins to move, we all have to make adjustments. And I was just writing a speech for a presentation I'm giving in Chicago in a couple weeks, and one of the things I just wrote is that people tend to have a static view of history. One of the things that strikes me is that many people's view of history really hasn't budged since 1968, even though historians have been busily revising our interpretations of the past. And likewise, I think that many things that we seem to think of as verities or as eternal truths, such as domination by the North Atlantic powers and the United States in the first place, well, no, you know, that's crumbling before our very eyes. And so, therefore, we are all going to have to make adjustments. I think that people with sovereignty, like our brothers and sisters in African Caribbean, they've begun to make that adjustment. We in North America have to do the same thing.
Thank you so much, Gerald, for being with us, and I hope we'll be back again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you for
coming up next is Richard Martin. Stay tuned, and thank you for being with me today.
Oh, no.